Hello, I'm Rosemary Martirana, Director of Intelligence here at the New Jersey Office of Homeland Security and Preparedness, NJOHSP, and you're listening to Intelligence Unclassified. This podcast is exactly what the title states, unclassified information about current trends in homeland security for the state of New Jersey, as well as educational information and resources for your awareness. Although it is produced every month, we aim to stay on top of current events and will often offer additional content. If this is your first time listening, then thanks for coming. Please feel free to add this podcast to your RSS feed or iTunes. You can also follow NJOHSP on Twitter at NJOHSP and Facebook. All links can be found in the show note and on our website, www.njohsp.gov. In November 2015, NJOHSP and the New York State Intelligence Center, along with the New Jersey Regional Intelligence Academy and McLaughlin, hosted a one-day seminar joining together Clint Watts, Dr. William McCants, J.M. Berger, and Seamus Hughes to discuss the current threat of violent extremists and how law enforcement and homeland security professionals may counter it. NJOHSP analysts had the opportunity to interview these experts and engage in valuable dialogue surrounding a variety of terrorism-related topics.
Good afternoon. My name is Kim Brown with the New Jersey Office of Homeland Security and Preparedness, and today I'll be interviewing J.M. Berger. J.M. Berger is a non-resident fellow in the Project on U.S. Relations with the Islamic World in the Center for Middle East Policy. With roots in newspaper journalism, Berger is an author and analyst studying extremism. He is the co-author of ISIS, The State of Terror, with Jessica Stern. Berger has written extensively on the evolution of Al-Qaeda and the rise of the so-called Islamic State. He interviewed American Al-Shabaab member Omar Hamami at length and published a widely read account of their interactions after the jihadist was killed by his former allies in 2013. I'd like to thank you for coming and having us interview you. And with that, I'd like to begin our interview.
Okay, thank you for having me.
Okay, the first question is about eco and animal rights activity. Specifically looking at the activity in New Jersey, the environment is ripe for extremist activity, but we haven't really been seeing anything. Would you be able to comment on that?
Well, I think there's probably a couple factors at play in that. I mean, primarily, I think environmental issues and animal rights issues have really become very mainstreamed. So there are mainstream outlets for people to talk about it and try and make a difference. And, you know, and we've seen both companies and government have kind of responded to that, too, with new kinds of regulations and guidelines. So, you know, some radical groups that start off as extremists or violent extremists can sometimes become part of the mainstream of society. If you look at the civil rights movement, really that's a case of something that was perceived as radical, that was responded to by the government as radical, but it became very much part of the mainstream. And so the complexion of the movement has changed, and we don't really look at that as extremism anymore.
Great. Okay, the next question I have you seen any evidence of domestic terror groups borrowing media tactics from ISIS?
I have seen some evidence of that. White supremacists seem to be the first to really start emulating what ISIS does. Most recently, they engaged in a hashtag campaign to boycott Star Wars 7 because they were objecting to the fact that there are African Americans or Africans, just Africans, who have prominent roles in the movie. And so they managed to scare up some media coverage, and they managed to get the hashtag trending by operating in a very coordinated way, similar to what ISIS does. And then beyond that, we are also seeing Al-Qaeda slowly trying to adapt and catch up with ISIS on their social media game.
Do you think that there would be other groups out there, domestic extremist groups, that would try to employ similar tactics?
I think it's likely we're going to see this more and more. I mean, you know, people use social media in their lives in a lot of different ways, and extremists do the same thing that everybody else does. You know, there's a real power, I think, in social media for extremists in particular, as opposed to mainstream society. You know, the structure of our mass media, TV, radio, that kind of stuff is all really kind of in to reinforce the status quo to a certain point. They reflect the very broad values of the mainstream at large. Social media takes away that constraint. You don't have to have $1 million to set up a TV studio. You can just get on Twitter and start finding people and become active. So I think it's natural that extremists would start to exploit that more than mainstream movements.
So do you think that that would lend itself to more lone wolf attacks or more organized attacks, maybe from groups looking at domestic terrorist groups?
It's going to be different kinds of action from different groups. ISIS is one of the most violent groups that we've seen in modern history. And so, you know, they have an extraordinary ability to motivate lone wolves because of their violence in part and because of their social media tactics in part. So, white supremacists have long been advocates of the lone wolf model, but they've never been able to make it work. So we might see that start to happen in a more effective way.
Right. You touched on this earlier. Do you think that we could expect a wide range of terrorist groups, both IT and DT, to exploit racial issues in the United States?
We've seen some efforts to do that. I mean, so racist groups are inherently racial. Right. So they're already on that as much as they can be. We've seen ISIS try to exploit racial divisions in the United States, for instance, by jumping on hashtags for Ferguson and Baltimore. And it doesn't seem to be working very well for them. So I don't know how much it's possible for them to piggyback onto those kinds of movements.
Okay. And how much freedom do the Al-Qaeda affiliates have with their messaging?
Well, the Al-Qaeda affiliates at this point, I suspect, have a lot of freedom in their messaging because Al-Qaeda Central is very quiet these days. So, we've seen the spectacle of having Ayman al-Zawahiri rush out an audio message in August to acknowledge the death of Mullah Omar. And then Al-Qaeda subsequently released a series of lectures by Zawahiri in which he said that the Islamic State was invalid because everybody had already pledged to Mullah Omar. And, obviously Mullah Omar's dead.
Right.
So that speaks to a communication and command and control apparatus that is in a shambles. And I think that it's pretty hard to see how any of the affiliates could be taking very fine-grained advice from them. But each one is different. So Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula is most aligned with the priorities of Al-Qaeda Central.
Mm-hmm.
Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb is a mess right now because of ISIS, because of splintering due to ISIS and due to other splintering that's been happening in there.
Mm-hmm.
Al-Shabaab is kind of off on its own tangent. In some ways, it doesn't really feel very connected to Al-Qaeda Central at all, even though they still are in name. So, and then al-Nusra is also, after AQAP, is probably the most attuned to Al-Qaeda Central's priorities. So it's unclear, whether any kind of directive from Al-Qaeda Central might be holding back groups like al-Nusra and AQAP from taking a more aggressive stand on their media.
Mm-hmm.
But they may just simply be slow to adapt. Or, ISIS does adopt a lot of stuff that's done by its supporters. So they're much more encouraging of kind of grassroots efforts to put the message out, and they will sometimes, promote those. So they have like an official media apparatus that really only puts out a couple of videos a year. And then they have a lot of supporting media groups that put out many, much more content.
Right. Okay. And since you touched on, I guess, kind of the back and forth from groups and maybe like a tug of war as far as who's in charge, do you see the attacks in Paris, Beirut, and the Sinai as an attempt by ISIS to outbid Al-Qaeda?
There may be an element of that in it, although I think this is kind of an expected behavior from ISIS. The terrorist attacks of the last 3 weeks have really helped ISIS to change the conversation when it's losing on the ground. On November 12th, everybody was talking about ISIS losing Sinjar. And on November 14th, everybody was talking about ISIS rampaging out of control over the globe. This is kind of an expected outgrowth of their activities. And there was significant evidence that they had both the intention and the capability to pull off these kinds of strikes.
Do you think that with the, I just received the email earlier today, and I'm sure you knew about it as well, the release of Dabiq, ISIS's English language magazine, and it had talk of the Paris attacks, the plane. So do you think that the magazine was already put together prior to this and they just had to hit send, or do you have an opinion?
So since it came while we're actually here today doing these training sessions, I haven't had a chance to read it in detail. I think it's pretty clear that at least there was some preparation that went into the Russian plane claim, mm-hmm. because there was a picture of that they claimed was the IED that was used to bring the plane down. Whether that's true or not, we're not sure. As far as the Paris stuff, at my first glance, it looked like a lot of that could have been culled from news coverage, but I haven't had a chance to give it a close read yet.
And do you think that with the release of the magazine, the success of the attacks, maybe what would we expect as far as like the recruitment by ISIS then? So do you think this is going to assist them in recruiting more fighters?
It probably will help some around the margins. I think what we're probably seeing is a certain plateau in ISIS recruitment. So foreign fighter flows have slowed down.
Okay.
The foreign media, social media presence seems to have flattened out, although that is partly due to accounts being suspended.
Mm-hmm.
But ultimately, ISIS is a fringe of a fringe of a fringe. So, you know, Islamism is not even mainstream Islam. And then jihadism is the fringe of Islamism. And then ISIS is the fringe of jihadism. So, you know, there may only be so many people in the world who are really going to be inclined to sign up for this group. And, you know, we're probably not at the limit yet. But I think there's certainly some reason to sort of look at how things have been going for them lately and to think that some of the wind is going out of their sails. Whether they can change that dynamic with terrorist attacks or with some kind of military advancement, it's not totally clear. But, you know, my opinion is that ISIS owes a lot of its success to its ability to scour the world for the very small percentage of people who are inclined toward violence and receptive to their ideas. And, you know, I think there's probably a ceiling on that number.
Yes. Well, I would like to thank you for letting us interview you today. Your presentation was great as usual. And with that being said, we're signing off.
Thank you.
Again, all links can be found in the show notes and on our website at www.njohsp.gov. Thanks for listening, and don't forget to subscribe to Intelligence Unclassified.